please. We will take case number 3 under advisement. Wisconsin Right to Life, Wisconsin Right to Life Political Action Committee versus John C. Schobert, Wisconsin Election Board.
May it please the court. My name is Jim Bopp. I represented the plaintiffs below and the appellants here before this court. On December 2002, Judge Crabb enjoined recent changes in the Wisconsin Election Law, Act 109, at the request of Wisconsin realtors and other plaintiffs. The state knew and agreed that this injunction applied only to the plaintiffs in the realtor's case. As they stated in their response to the TRO and PI motion on page 5 in the court below, they said the Wisconsin realtor's injunction applies, quote, only to the named plaintiff in Wisconsin Realtors, end of quote. Fearful that the statute, when it went into effect on July 1, 2003, would be applied against them, the plaintiffs asked for an advisory opinion from the election board on whether or not they would enforce Act 109 against them or people that were not protected by the district court's injunction. The board refused to answer this advisory opinion request and then posted Act 109 on their website without any indication that it was enjoined or that they would not enforce the act against other parties other than those protected by the Wisconsin Realtors injunction. On July 1, the act went into effect, and there was a special election on July 23rd, which the plaintiffs wished to engage in certain communications that were prohibited by the act. Therefore, they had a dilemma. They could either have their speech chilled, suffering a First Amendment injury, they could violate the law as if they were lawless, or they could do the honorable thing, which they did, that is to file suit in order to gain the protection of the same injunction that the court had issued with the Wisconsin realtors. However, the district court denied the injunction and dismissed the action. There's no question, it seems to me, under the law, that with Judge Crabb's judgment extended only to the plaintiffs in that case. Rule 65D applies only to the plaintiffs in the action. This court in Trice in 1997 explained that a judgment or decree among the parties to a lawsuit involves issues as among them, but it does not conclude the rights of strangers to those proceedings. The U.S. Supreme Court has explained...
The judgment of the district court was that this section of the law was unconstitutional. It wasn't just unconstitutional as applied to the realtor, but was that it was unconstitutional.
It was a typical facial declaration. So it was unconstitutional.
How could the state then, in the face of that order, enforce that law against anybody else unless they were able to have it overturned?
Because neither injunctions under Rule 65 nor declarations under the Declaratory Judgment Act extend beyond the parties to the case. Now, occasionally, courts do enter injunctions or declarations that extend beyond, such as to enjoin them from enforcing the act against similarly situated parties. That was not done here. So the general rule applies. The declaration and injunction, as the U.S. Supreme Court said in Kennedy, quote, neither declaratory nor injunctive relief can directly interfere with enforcement of contested statutes or ordinances except with respect to the particular federal plaintiffs involved. So absent language in the declaration or the injunction that other non-parties were protected, the general rule applies.
But a typical injunction action is... injunctive order would say you cannot do this particular thing, or you must do, if an affirmative injunction, you must do this particular thing. But here you have a declaration, a decision by the federal court in Madison that the statute is unconstitutional.
Yes.
A section of it is unconstitutional because it has this non-severability clause. The whole statute is unconstitutional and unenforceable. I just don't know how that could be misinterpreted by someone who's fearful of engaging in constitutionally protected activity.
Well,
fearing prosecution or some sort of litigation based on that statute.
Your Honor, the U.S. Supreme Court has addressed that question directly and specifically in Kennedy in 1963. And there they had a law which had been declared under the Declaratory Judgment Act to be unconstitutional. And the court said, quote, the government has been free to continue to apply the statute as to other parties. Declaratory relief is actually less weighty, if you will, in its effect than an injunction. Because a declaration, while declaring the rights between the parties, does not tell the defendant, in this case, what to do or not to do. That is the additional step of an injunction. That is, you are enjoined from enforcing it. So the fact remains, and of course there's no case to the contrary, for there is no law to the contrary, that both declarations and injunctions only govern the rights and imposes obligations to the extent there are injunctions between the parties. Now, I think these plaintiffs have done the prudent thing. The first thing they did, I mean, they were active contesting this law anyway. The Attorney General of Wisconsin had filed suit in the state Supreme Court to have this act declared unconstitutional, and they moved to intervene in that state court, Supreme Court proceeding. So they were taking steps because they felt that this act was unconstitutional. The state Supreme Court, however, refused to do it. The realtors chose federal court in the meantime, and very soon after the state Supreme Court said they were not going to take up the case, the declaration was issued in the federal case. Well, the plaintiffs then said, okay, we need, recognizing as the state says repeatedly, they said in the transcript of the preliminary injunction hearing, quote, our position is that injunction admittedly does not, and this is to quote from the case law dealing with this, does not directly apply to right to life, and that we are willing to concede. They did a prudent thing, which is to ask, rather than just file suit and say, well, we want an injunction too, they asked the state for an advisory opinion. If the state would have given them an advisory opinion, they would have been legally protected by the operation of the advisory opinion. They refused. Then they post on their website this alleged, this enjoined law as to the realtors, which they now claim they had a secret non-enforcement policy with respect to. This
also,
court,
you're into your rebuttal time.
I'll make one more point. Thank you, Your Honor. This court in Majors versus Abel, which is really on point on the fact that the injury derives from the statute itself, and the fact that this court will look at the website as to the real position, if you will, of the state on such matters. And the state, at best, had a secret non-enforcement policy, which they refused to tell the plaintiffs when they asked them about.
All right, counsel.
May it please the court, I'm Tom Ballesteri, Assistant Wisconsin Attorney General, representing the members of the Wisconsin Elections Board.
You didn't advise them initially, did you, when they request for...
I most certainly did not. And let me assure you that my subsequent advice to them has convinced them that they were wrong in not giving right to life an opinion. Mr. Bopp continues to ignore what is absolutely the critical fact in this case, and that is that the revisions of the Wisconsin campaign finance law that were accomplished by 2001 Wisconsin Act 109 contained a non-severability clause. That clause stated that if any provision of the wide-ranging set of revisions was declared unconstitutional, that all of the revisions were void. Judge Crabb, in the Wisconsin Realtors case, declared one of the provisions of 2001 Act 109 unconstitutional. And as a result of that declaration of unconstitutionality, the entire set of revisions in Act 109 became and continues to this day to be void, legally non-existent, and unenforceable as a matter of law. Now, Right to Life says that they want the same protections that were given the Wisconsin realtors in their action before the district court. Namely, they want an injunction too. But they can't have an injunction. Wisconsin Right to Life is prohibited by Article 3 of the United States Constitution from obtaining an injunction because they don't have standing to sue in this case. The realtors had standing to sue in their case because at the time they sued, there was a legally viable law that could be enforced against them to their detriment. That law was voided as a result of the realtor's case, long before Right to Life brought this case. At the time Right to Life brought this case, there no longer exists a legally viable, enforceable law that can be enforced against Right to Life or anybody else. That law is void. It is legally gone. It does not exist. Now, the premise...
And as you know, that statement made by the board, if they would have made it in response, would have been the end of it.
I'm not sure it would have. Actually, I'm not sure it would have. Because in response to this litigation, the board sent Mr. Bopp a second letter explaining that position.
Well, yeah, that was quite a ways after the initial request.
It was. But... prior to the, but I will point this out, prior to the initial request, the Wisconsin Attorney General had taken the position before the Wisconsin Supreme Court that the statute, that the revisions were unconstitutional and therefore void. That was a public position taken in a judicial action. Actually, and kind of ironically, about the same time, within a day or two, of the time that the Elections Board refused to give Mr. Bopp an opinion, the Wisconsin legislature didn't pass the statute, but they put on the books and on their website a statute in which the Legislative Reference Board, which is the Legislative Reference Bureau, which is the body that drafts statutes and advises the legislature about the effect of the statute, put on its website this statute, and the Legislative Reference Bureau specifically stated once again, this statute was found unconstitutional, it's void, it's unenforceable, therefore we have to adopt a new one. So regardless of what the board did, Right to Life and anybody else from two sources, two very authoritative sources, not to mention the opinion of Judge Crabb, knew that this statute was not just unconstitutional in part, but was void and could not be enforced against anybody. The legal premise stated in Right to Life's reply brief is a logical impossibility, the premise upon which their argument is based. And that is that a statute or that anything can be void and not exist as to some people and yet be not void and can exist as to other people. That's a logical impossibility. If the statute is void and has no legal existence as to one person, it's void and has no legal existence as to anybody. And that includes Right to Life. Even if that premise had been tenable, however, Right to Life's argument is wrong, because what they say is, well, the statute must be in existence as to somebody because Judge Crabb enjoined it. Well, that's erroneous because it confuses the who and the what. Judge Crabb did not enjoin the statute. J- Judge Crabb enjoined the elections board from enforcing the statute, and she enjoined the board from enforcing the statute. Why? Because it was void. It did not exist. There were no provisions to enforce, so Judge Crabb told the elections board, you can't enforce any part of a statute that doesn't exist. Nothing strange about that, nothing that's hard to understand, nothing illogical. Doesn't exist, you can't enforce it. Right to Life claims that the elections board was trying to chill Right to Life by not giving them an opinion. Well, I explained when we appeared before the district court why the opinion was withheld. As far as the chilling business goes, you can't chill somebody unless you've got the ice to chill them with. The board couldn't possibly chill Right to Life because they didn't have the ice. They have no statute which they can threaten to enforce against Right to Life or anybody else. Finally, I'd like to say that I'd like to address this argument in which Mr. Bopp faults the board for not changing the statute on its website. If you look at the website, and I've given you the web address, you can look at it for yourself. What the board has done on its website, they don't reproduce the statute on their website. What they do is they provide a link to the published statutes. They can't change the statute. The statute is there, it's on the books, only the legislature can change it. What the board has done, and admittedly somewhat belatedly, and I discussed this with the board too, they have put a disclaimer on their website at the point where they provide the link to the Wisconsin statute, saying that the published statute has been declared unconstitutional and the board is not going to enforce it. Now, Mr. Bopp says, well, that's wrong, because the statute hasn't been declared unconstitutional. Only one part of it was declared unconstitutional. It's really void. Well, that's correct. But this disclaimer on the board's website is not a legal document. It's not intended for judges or lawyers. It's intended for lay people who visit the website and want to know about elections law. Lay people understand unconstitutionality. They know that here's a statute that's still on the books, here's how it reads, but it's unconstitutional, so it can't be enforced. They understand that concept. I don't think that a lot of people would necessarily understand the concept of voidness, particularly as it exists in the context of this case, where one provision of a statute is unconstitutional and the rest of it, therefore, becomes void. The bottom line here, however, is simply this. Right to Life has no standing in this case because there is no statute that can be enforced against them. They cannot have an injunction because they have no standing to get one. They're just going to have to be satisfied with the protection that's available to everybody else, which is that there is no statute on the books that is legally valid, legally viable, and nobody can enforce it against them or anybody else. There is no standing in this case. Judge Crabb probably properly dismissed this case because of lack of standing under Article 3. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. 2 minutes here.
Thank you, Judge. The state relies upon the non-severability clause to create rights or obligations that go much beyond what the non-severability clause has anything to do with. Non-severability or severability clause, which is more common, simply gives the preference or the presumption that the state wants to assert as to which provisions are to be enjoined or declared invalid, not as to who they're to be declared invalid or enjoined against. I mean, when there's multiple provisions, you've got to, and one is declared unconstitutional, what do you do? Well, the federal court has an obligation to take a look at whether or not any of the other provisions go down with it. The severability or non-severability clause gives the states preference with respect to the exercise of that judgment by the federal court. So the severability or non-severability clause has to do with what provisions, which provisions, are to be declared invalid and enjoined, not as to whom. Secondly, you know, the opposite of this argument was played in the Fourth Circuit. I cited the Virginia Society for Human Life case. FEC regulations in a case that I represented the plaintiffs were declared invalid and enjoined, and the district court issued a broad injunction, a nationwide injunction, so that it could, you know, to enjoin the enforcement of those regulations against any similarly situated persons in the United States of America. The FEC appealed and said, no, that declaration and injunction is too broad. It should be limited only as the law requires, that be limited only to the parties in the case, and the Fourth Circuit agreed and limited that declaration and injunction only to those parties. That is the state of the law. That is, that there was, in fact, a statute on the books, posted on the website, against which there was no legal protection by these plaintiffs, and that's what they saw. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, counsel. The court will take the